This is ClearStead's Investment Forum, where we hold discussions with allocators, managers, and other industry leaders on current investment trends and topics. These conversations are led by members of our investment office who conduct research on investment strategies. Thank you in advance for listening, and we hope you enjoy the discussion.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Joe Bushell. In today's episode, we're fortunate to have with us Richard Socher, AX co-founder and founder of U.com, a search engine based on artificial intelligence, to talk to us today about the impact of artificial intelligence on investing and on our future. So welcome, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So, Richard, you have a very fascinating background. Can you give the audience some context of your background and how you began to work in artificial intelligence?
Happy to. Yeah, it started in 2003 when I started studying linguistic computer science back in Germany eventually ended up doing my PhD at Stanford in a little known field at the time, or intersection of fields of neural networks or so-called deep learning and natural language processing. At the time, it's a very controversial idea. There's maybe only two or three people who had worked and published papers in recent years. And I thought that was the right technology to solve a specific problem, namely to describe every word as a vector, lists of numbers, instead of discrete entities that have no real connection to one another. So there's some interesting philosophical connections to Wittgenstein and whatnot. But long story short, did my PhD in this idea of bringing neural nets to NLP, then afterwards started a company, but also on the side started teaching neural networks for natural language processing because no one in the world was teaching it. But then after 4 years, everyone started teaching it. The field had completely shifted. I stopped teaching at Stanford. During that time, my startup MetaMind, which brought neural networks to enterprise applications and to other companies, got acquired by Salesforce, where I became chief scientist and eventually executive vice president, running most of the AI efforts there. Had 4.5 very happy years, really built some large scale applications, started working on chatbots for search, for service, and could have been very happy there, but I couldn't also shake the idea off that the world needs a better search engine because all of this natural language processing technology has gotten so good, but the biggest application of it is still search. And that has stayed the same for the last 15 something years, just lists of blue links. And all right, so in 2018, we invented prompt engineering, for instance, which influenced OpenAI and thinking about GPT models. So we could basically train a single model for all of natural language processing on all the 10 hardest tasks. And, you know, they connected that with language modeling, which was brilliant, and scaled it up even further. And so long story short, in 2020, I started U.com. And then also, I was very fortunate after the acquisition in 2016 have had a lot of amazing students and interns and employees and friends. And I started investing some of the money I got from the acquisition into my community. And, I was very fortunate because a lot of them are very smart and accomplished incredible things and have since, 11x'd the portfolio value. And so to scale that further, I started AIX Ventures, which basically connects the top AI practitioners and researchers and founders together with an incredible VC team around Sean Johnson, my co-founder at AIX, to basically invest in the next generation of incredible AI companies. And yeah, I'm very excited how that's going too.
That's great. You guys at AX Ventures have a pretty interesting team, maybe a little bit of background on Sean and the rest of the team and sort of why you guys are working together.
Yeah, happy to. So Sean has been an operator and ran product design engineering teams at various Sequoia-backed companies, NimblerX and others, and has really helped sort of in the background support CEOs and startup founders. And that's, I think, exactly what you would want in a VC, someone who really helps those companies get to their next level, get from 0 to 1, but also from 1 to 10. So that's Sean. And then we also have this group of investing partners, and these investing partners are incredible AI researchers and founders. They're Chris Manning, the most cited person in natural language processing. I'm only the fourth most cited person in the field. Here's my PhD advisor, also one of my two PhD advisors, together with Andrew Ng, doing my PhD at Stanford. And he's incredible. Started the human-centered AI Institute and co-founded that at Stanford. Has advised many different companies over the years, and is an incredible knowledge source and researcher in the field of natural language processing and AI too, and sees a lot of incredible students in the Stanford CS department. And then we have Peter Beal, who is a robotics professor at Berkeley, one of the most famous robotics people out there. Also incredibly smart, hardworking, well-accomplished, has pushed the field of robotics forward a bunch, but also has started multiple different companies, has already had exits, currently has co-founded Covarian, a company that's still running in the logistics and warehousing space and automation there. And then we have Anthony Goldblum, the Kaggle CEO, who started Kaggle, just the largest machine learning community in the world, and ran a lot of different kinds of competitions in the years until they got acquired for a hefty sum by Google.
Wow, that's a pretty fascinating group that you guys are working with, and a lot of experience there. So it's pretty interesting. A lot of our audience, the audience here, is probably a little bit newer to artificial intelligence. Certainly, they read about it in the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. You'll probably see stories about it on the news. But, you know, maybe you can explain to us more broadly speaking, what is artificial intelligence and what does it sort of mean?
I'll try to keep it short so you can talk about that for a long time, especially as an ex-professor. But AI is a field of computer science that initially tried to map different kinds of human intelligence into computers. So humans have, you know, visual intelligence, and that became the field of computer vision. Humans have motor intelligence. You know, you can get paid a lot of money if you can throw small balls into small holes far away of various kinds as an athlete. And that's robotics. And then you have what I think is the most interesting manifestation of human intelligence, which is language understanding and generation. And that's mapped into the field of natural language processing. Eventually, the field grew out of those ambitions and even included things that humans cannot do. For instance, developing new kinds of drugs by understanding the language of proteins. It's a research paper me and my co-authors published also a few years ago. I think 2017 or 18 was the first one where we can generate new kinds of proteins. And for you know, those of you not familiar with biology, like, that proteins basically govern everything in the human body. And to be able to generate them the same way we can now chat in English, but you chat sort of with a protein model is very, very powerful and will lead to all kinds of new medicines. And this is helping currently speed up the development of new vaccines and a bunch of other incredible research. So there's some really, really cool work that AI can now do in automation and industrial automation and work automation that even humans couldn't quite do, you know, answer all kinds of questions, translate all kinds of different languages. These are all concrete applications of natural language processing, for instance, summarizing long form documents, generating text, writing poems. You name it. At this point, especially generative AI has had a breakthrough. It used to be that AI was mostly about understanding the world, you know, doing speech recognition and just transcribing spoken language into written language. But now it's more and more also generating new kinds of outputs, creating images, creating music, I think will come in the next few months and quarters. And yeah, of course, generating text.
Great. And another term that we've kind of heard a few times around artificial intelligence is this whole concept of machine learning. What does machine learning mean?
So Yeah. So the field used to start as AI. People thought, oh, we'll just in one summer, we will finish computer vision. And then maybe the next year, we'll finish the getting computers to understand natural language. And that all took a lot longer. And so, and these grand ambitions of just getting an AI to solve all of these different problems was very overly optimistically set. And so the field kind of said, well, there's still some great ideas in this field of AI, but maybe what we need to do is solve smaller, simpler problems. And then the field kind of fragmented into maybe we'll just solve logic problems. And that became an area historically. Then some folks just looked at what we call statistical or pattern recognition. And out of that historically came sort of the machine learning community that used much more statistics and complex probabilistic models to basically understand and solve a much more well-constrained and simpler task. And they set their expectations much lower. We just want to do sentiment analysis, or we just want to classify edges and identifying sort of most important regions of an image, and maybe classify also like cats versus dogs, but it didn't work very well because it was a very complex problem. And so machine learning is essentially, can be seen TLDR as just a subfield of AI overall.
Yep, great. And we also talked about this. I know you got your PhD in neural networks. So what are really neural networks? Maybe just from a high level quickly, you know, for the audience that doesn't have a background in engineering. So
yeah, a neural network, to really fully understand it will take us a little bit longer, but it's essentially an algorithm that has a ton of free parameters, knobs you can tune in order to predict something. And at a high level, it is still a very large statistical learning model that you give a lot of training data into in order to then give you a specific kind of output. So for example, you can give it like millions of images or thousands of images of, you know, this is a cat. The output is you have to say it's a cat. And then you show it 1,000 images of dogs. And then the output is this is a dog. And then after a while, this neural network can, given a new image, say, is it a cat or a dog? If you only give it cat or dog in the training set, it will, you know, you can give it an image of a calculator, it'll still say cat or dog, you know? And so they're not magic. They're taking some input X and they're mapping it to some output Y. But when they're very, very large, they can do incredible things. And if the input is, here's a sentence, predict what the next word of that sentence is. It turns out they can learn so many things about culture and geography and so on. And just to give you a sense of why, one of these neural networks that's very popular right now is a large language model, or GPT. Transformers are particular types of neural networks, the T of GPT. And the problem that was really cleverly set was predict the next word. And imagine you see the sentence on Wikipedia or somewhere on the internet and says, oh, I was in New York City and then I was driving north too. Now, in order to predict the next word, you had to actually understand geography, right? Like, you know, oh, I want to put high probability on the word being Boston or Montreal, maybe Yale or something like that. And then depending on how big the city is, you probably want to put more probability on that to make it a correct prediction that the next word is maybe Boston. And so before you know it, a model that is trained on billions and billions and billions of sequences of text learns a lot of interesting world knowledge. And that was a really tough nut to crack, to get world knowledge to be infused into these neural networks like that. And so I'll stop there. But basically, at this point, neural networks are general algorithms that can predict a lot of different outputs given inputs. And that, again, these inputs can be written like text. And usually these are different models. Some are for text, some are for vision, some are for speech, some are for proteins. Maybe over time, we can merge them more and more and do more and more multitask and multimodal kinds of neural networks. But for now, they take in one kind of input type, and then it makes certain predictions.
That's fascinating. And it, As you sort of said, like all these different nodes and things, and these, how much computer power do you need to sort of run one of these neural networks? It sounds like, is it something I can eventually put in my phone, or is it something that it requires a multiple servers across the world or the US? And I mean, how much computing power is it needed just to figure out, okay, you know, to understand that I might be driving up to Boston from New York? I mean, and all the, you know, all the potential possibilities and to calculate it.
Yeah, so that highly depends. A neural network can be as small as having, you know, 5-10 neurons, and then you can run it on like your old calculator, or it can have as many as 200 billion or more parameters. And the bigger they get, the beefier the machines need to be to run them. And the simplest one, we have one company called Useful Sensors by Pete Warden. He wants to be able to put a little neural net chip into every light switch. So you can just walk by a light switch and snap your fingers and then boom, the light turns on. Or into every Barbie doll, so it always like identifies visually who Ken is and things like that. So there's all kinds of very small embedded chips you can build for very small, simple neural networks. But the really big ones that can predict so many things about geography and natural language or generate massive new protein sequences, those usually have many billions of parameters, and they need very beefy GPUs. They're usually in the cloud, and NVIDIA makes a lot of money with them because that's the main hardware that everyone currently uses for training all their neural nets.
That's fascinating. I appreciate that. Yeah, what makes today a really good time to invest in artificial intelligence? I mean, you've been doing this since the early 2000s, and you know, obviously people have been studying neural networks even before then. So what's so great about today?
So to be honest, the best part to invest in AI was probably like in the last couple of years already. It started to be a really good thing when I started doing it in 2016. You know, companies like Hugging Face, I think I invested in 2016 or 17. At a $5 million valuation, they're worth over $2 billion now. But overall, the AI field is getting better and better, and the abilities are getting bigger and bigger. So we're currently at the beginning of this kind of exponential phase. It's like selling bandwidth when the iPhone just came out, and people are like, "I want to be able to watch YouTube videos on the go," and so. There are all kinds of incredible applications, and it's changing. It's going to change and is already in the process of changing many different industries, as I predicted for many years. And so it is an incredible time right now because we've crossed many different thresholds. The field of language generation has gotten better and better, and language is how we govern everything at work. You know, every communication between humans and coordination is a natural language. You know, we can understand the visual world a lot better. Robotics is still really hard, and startups have a hard time with hardware because, unlike in software, it's very hard to iterate super quickly in hardware. So there's still that is probably something that will happen in the next 10 to 30 years is where we actually start making some real progress on robotics and the physical world. But for now, anything in the future of work is going to massively change. Every process where a human basically repeats something quite similar multiple times, in the future, they're going to be like, "Wait, I already answered this email type 2 dozen times. Why has the AI not picked that up yet?" You know, that's what people are going to think. And so the people that help with this new step function in human productivity and efficiency are the ones who are going to massively benefit from it.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned Hugging Face. Maybe for the audience who's not familiar, what is Hugging Face? What's sort of the benefits today? And obviously it's being used quite a bit. But maybe also in addition to Hugging Face, what are some other companies right now that are getting a lot of attention? And maybe what do they do that sort of helps with productivity or business or, I mean, just make our lives better, I guess?
Yeah, there are a ton. So Hugging Face in particular, it's quite a technical and nerdy company. It's not a consumer oriented company. It's basically an AI hub. If you're somewhat technical, it's like the GitHub of AI, where instead of just sharing your code with other researchers. You share your code and your trained model and how you trained that model, and you let someone test out the model, and you let them look at the data set and everything you need to understand and run your machine learning models in production, you can find from Hugging Face. So as an AI developer and programmer, it makes your life massively easier to use Hugging Face. And at this point, all the large companies are using it in one way or another, and many are contributing to it. We see a ton more really exciting companies that are making our lives better. So I'll just stick to some that are in the AIX Ventures portfolio. One is called Athelas. They are basically helping medical providers with remote care programs. It started out as doing at-home blood measurements, which is now a companion diagnostic. So when you need to know your red and white blood cell count, for instance, you can measure it at home and then take just the right amount of a drug for instance, for cancer patients, which is infinitely better than having to go to a hospital with a bunch of other sick people if you're already immunocompromised and so on. But that's how they started. Now they're moving more and more into revenue cycle management and automating more and more processes that are downstream from that, and helping lots of patients. Another company we have is called Atmo. They provide nation's weather prediction services and weather forecasting services, and are extremely accurate, and they use neural networks because, again, you have a lot of inputs, a lot of sensors and measurements and so on, and you want to predict something, which is the output, wind, precipitation, temperature, and so on in certain regions. And so they can do that much more accurately, taking into consideration the terrain and helping a lot of countries to now have their own weather forecasting services and not be dependent on outside folks. We have Atomic AI. They're building new kind of RNA sequences to develop new drugs. We have Covariant, of course, from Peter Abeil, an AI robotics platform that helps automate things in warehouses. So, you have a big box with a bunch of different products. Someone buys a particular kind of product. You want to have a robotic arm that's able to pick out one product and put it into a box. It's currently done by humans, can be very much automated. We have so many more where, like, maybe I'll look into or mention just two or three more. One is called MoonHub. They are essentially an AI recruiter, and they help everyone become, and they have very easy access with natural language to a vast pool of candidates. And you can describe candidates in a much more complex kind of way, saying, oh, I want people who worked in startups for at least like 2 or 3 years. And ideally, the startups had some good VCs and, things like that. Then, it kind of helps understand what that actually means in terms of what the candidates look like. We have a company called Profluent Bio. They are essentially doing this protein generation that helps create new kinds of drugs. And I think that kind of work will automate or improve all of biology. And someone related to this, another company we have is called Vivo. They're doing AI for drug discovery. And build a foundational model of the cell, and what they're able to do is collect much like training data much, much more efficiently. And then maybe one more unicorn to round it out with is Weights and Biases. They also help AI practitioners run very efficient experimentations and understand how well their algorithms work while they're training them.
Oh, it's fascinating. So there's obviously a plethora of areas that we can use. You can use AI to improve your life. So that's really interesting. So there's probably tons of opportunities for you guys to invest in. Obviously, lots of different verticals that AI is sort of being used to sort of make improvements. But like, how do you guys separate good investments from hype? And I'm sure there's thousands of companies out there that everybody probably, I feel like even from us where we sit in our seat, we see lots of people saying, hey, look, this company's AI, this has been, and they've been around for 20 years and they probably haven't done anything different. Like, how do you separate something that's really truly AI and really attractive to invest in, as opposed to just sort of somebody's just trying to use AI as hype and to drum up money? So.
Yeah, it's so interesting and difficult for normal folks and folks who last year were just, you know, crypto experts to now become AI experts in a very short amount of time. And we see a lot of folks trying, of course, because, you know, it makes sense because it is a very transformational technology and it makes sense to get into it. But I think there's a lot of complexity because AI is getting bigger and easier to use. And more use cases are becoming more and more apparent to people in terms of how we can automate our workflows and our work lives. And you also don't have to be as deep of an expert anymore. There's a lot of things to Hugging Face and Weights and Biases and other companies. It is becoming easier and easier to build incredible AI applications and build out your own kind of workflows with AI. And so what we look for is a couple of things. We look at, you know, the founders and how smart they are, how hardworking they are. We look at founding teams. We look at the technical risks, of course, and you know, there are some founders, few of the founders that really don't know AI come to us as a venture fund because they know we know what we're talking about because we've been doing AI research, several of us, for over a decade. And if they say, oh, I'm going to use AI for this, we're like, that's not going to work. And here are all the reasons. Maybe people have tried it and we've seen it already. We know it's not technically feasible. And so we can evaluate this technical risk, I think, better than any other AI fund out there. But that is just one. You then have, you know, the sort of industry risks associated, you know, in healthcare is pretty complex. Getting real products out into the world, you know, requires many years and FDA approvals, and there's a lot of complexity there. You know, there are other kinds of regulated industries. You look at sort of the go-to-market risks and, you know, is there need for the product? Have they thought about their sales? There's some very young folks who say, oh, I want to work in, you know, AI for agriculture. And I'm like, have you gotten your boots dirty in your life before? And, you know, if they've never been out in the field and talked to farmers, they're just like very sort of Silicon Valley folk. It's very hard to, you know, get out and get that sales process going. On you know, flip side, it's very hard to sell into healthcare if you don't have any healthcare experts in your team. And B2B is also not always easy, right? So you need to think about your sales motion distribution. And there's some classics that still hold even in the age of AI. You still need to, you know, have good sales and distribution models or ideas for, you know, how to grow in a consumer space, which is also very competitive. And then we look at a little bit what kinds of moats can those companies over time build. One thing that's amazing with these large language models and foundational models is that you can get in NLP applications, natural language processing, you can quickly get to an 80% solution. But then the trick is to keep making it better and better over time in order to start just being obviously more accurate than your competition. So one example of that, for instance, is Ambience. It's a company that I'm invested in that transcribes doctor appointments and basically leads to less physician burnout because they just, they have the conversation with their patient. The AI takes the notes, writes the report, and then they can just quickly read it and skim it and say, yes, this is accurate, maybe make one or two edits and then send it out. And that saves them like 5-10 minutes per patient visit. Don't quote me on that exact number, but it saves them several minutes. Yep. Over time, you know, you have to actually collect that kind of data and get better and better at it, knowing what physicians' codes they're using and so on to make that a very accurate prediction. And so that's what we want to see long term in these companies is that As they run their companies more and more, they collect more data, they become better and get better than competition that comes in.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think you brought up one thing during that answer that I thought was a little interesting too. You said, some of these, ideas from a technological standpoint don't work at the AI. So maybe what are some of those areas that people have tried to use AI to tackle that don't really work, that doesn't really work, and AI is not really the solution?
I mean, there are some problems in society just generally that are much more easily solved with regulation or sort of policy changes than with AI. I think AI does eventually make sense in almost every industry somewhere, but there are still certain areas where it is just much, much more powerful than others. So, for instance, I think if you have a long B2B sales process, I think AI can still be used in a variety of places, like predicting next best steps. If you have like millions of training sequences of steps of like, this is how we close some large deal, but a very large B2B deal will probably still need human interaction, right? Yeah. And there is less automation versus like service, for instance, where you have a ton of quite repetitive inputs and outputs. Input is an email, output needs to be the answer to that service question. Input is like a text in a chat, output is like, the answer to that customer question. And each of them doesn't make, a million plus dollars, but each costs like a few dollars. And if you can automate it, it's just much, much more, much, much more efficient and cost saving. There are some other things right now that, people are interested in, for instance, generating videos. And generating videos can be done, but right now it's still tricky to have these videos be very consistent over a long period of time. So you have one character and 5 minutes later, that character still needs to look the same. And that is an interesting research project. And so if you wanted to work on that as a startup, we would want to see that you have some research chops and actually know how to modify these algorithms, because you can't just take the existing algorithm as is and improve and then just say, oh, now it works for videos too.
Okay, that's great. And then, so what are some of the risks of investing in maybe today in AI, and maybe let's tie this into how do we expect the space to evolve in the next 3 to 5 years? Is there a potential you guys are investing in technology companies that are going to be obsolete 3 to 5 years from now? Sort of how should we look at, the evolution of the space, and how does that impact how you guys are investing?
Of course, it's hard to fully know and predict the future with perfect accuracy, right? And venture capital usually follows a power law where you have a few breakout stars that pay back an entire portfolio. But it's also very clear that right now it's actually, and this is, I think, why there's so many folks coming in, it is somewhat easier to invest in AI than it is to invest in, time travel or invisibility cloaks or other technology that's not quite proven and is not growing as much. And so the fact is, like, AI is working better and better as an underlying technology. And just like when the internet just came out and people realized the potential, you can make a lot more mistakes to some degree also, because the field overall is growing so much. But I just mentioned all the things we're looking for, and they each have a flip side. So I looked at and talked about founders, founding team, go to market, distribution, technology risk, industry risk, and so on. So those are all the things that we're looking for to reduce that risk. And so far our fund one already looks extremely promising in the returns and the TVPI. Personally, like, if I look at all the investments I've made so far, they've 11x in value, which is better than most any other financial instrument that I know of in the last five or so years. I think past performance does not indicate future performance, but so far so good.
So I think that we maybe talked about this a little bit, and there's certainly been a lot of press about, AI sort of disintermediating, impacting employment, How does AI impact the number of programmers that are, you know, working for, you know, tech companies? I work in finance. Can AI do financial modeling and replace me or maybe some of my my junior employees? And, you know, I think the big, I know you're working with this at Salesforce, but the one that always fascinates me is customer service, right? I'm always frustrated. I'm so shocked that I can't, when I type in a chat boxes, sometimes I just get, you know, generic FAQ answers. So where do you think AI goes as far as, you know, impacting employment and those kind of things? So,
yeah, so I think AI will impact employment massively. I think we will see a ton of jobs being very different in the next several years, because again, when something is repetitive, when you do the same kind of, you answer the same kind of question, you make the same kind of prediction many times in a row, you would assume an AI will pick up and take over that task for you. And so that is a massive change. Just like, you know, 150 years ago, over 90% of people worked in agriculture. Now, if you ask someone, would you want to work back in the field manually? People would say, no, that's crazy. But there are a lot of jobs where I think 100 years from now, people are like, why would you do that? Why would you drive by yourself in a truck with no friends and so on, like for hundreds of miles? That seems kind of like a boring job. But, you know, right now people appreciate having a job, but just like people used to appreciate having a job, working in the field, providing for their families, making money. But I think that will change to a very large degree. And just like muscle, you know, strong muscles are not as valuable anymore since physical labor became more and more automated. I think being able to, in a kind of rote, boring way, do repetitive tasks very quickly is also not going to be as valuable as we can automate more and more of those tasks, you know, in logistics and warehouses, for instance. But also when it comes to answering the same kind of, oh, this customer is asking how to recover their account and then how to go an email and how, where their order is and how can they, you know, replace their order and whatnot. Like those things, as they become very, you know, seen very frequently in your training data, you will be able to automate. So I don't think that will happen like overnight. And there were a lot of folks who were sort of incorrect too when computer vision started to work. About, you know, 5 or so years ago, you know, we published ImageNet together with co-authors like many years ago, but that was sort of the founding. It was in 2008, I think. The paper awards here. But yeah, that has been a long time ago. Computer vision started to work, and because vision and understanding images, not generating but understanding images, had gotten so good, people said, oh, we're not going to need radiologists anymore in a few years. But that was actually an incorrect prediction. And we still need radiologists because there is not enough training data to really be able to get millions of images of everything that could be wrong in many kinds of scans. But there are also some kinds of scans that only are looking for one thing. For instance, breast cancer scans only look for breast cancer. You can actually build certain things or macular degeneration, you know, in your eyes, you're only looking for one particular problem, and then AI can do very well for those particular applications. But can they replace the entire radiologist or pathologist? No. Not yet. And that will take a lot longer because you don't have enough training data and you need even different ways of learning from data, namely through descriptions similar to textbooks rather than just getting millions and millions of training samples. So long story short, AI will modify most jobs. My hunch is when you have 100 people, in many cases, they will be replaced by 10 people knowing how to use AI rather than all be replaced and that job is completely gone in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, that might be helpful too. There's certain areas where we don't have enough employees already, right? So you can augment them and not have to, you know, be able to provide better service or whatever.
Tasks, so. Like, you know, even in agriculture still, I mean, that's still like, I think around 5% or so of people work in agriculture. There are a lot of jobs where fruits and vegetables go to waste because no one wants to pick them. It's not a fun job that people like grow up and be like, you know what I want to do? Stand in the field every day and pick blueberries. It's a really tough job. But, you know, we love blueberries. They're very tasty. Someone's got to do it. But I think AI can automate that and help reduce waste there also.
Yeah, that's great. So another term that, you know, you definitely hear a lot nowadays is AGI. And maybe you can describe for us what AGI is. Do you think we'll ever see a true AGI system? How might that impact us? And I think AGI is also the area I think that's creating a lot of fear, right? Not outside of employment, maybe is, you know, maybe does AI, especially when it pertains to AGI, need to be regulated? So what's your thoughts on AGI in general? So what is it?
Yeah, so AGI stands for artificial general intelligence. And now people amped it up even more and call it super intelligence and things like that. It's basically the idea that, well, if we can build something that's sort of smart, can we just make it a little bit, give it more compute, a little bit more data, and then it becomes super smart. And then when it's super smart and intelligent, it can do even more things than we can do as a human. It will outcompete us massively as a human. And then, you know, you get into very fantastical, cool sci-fi scenarios of, you know, Terminator-like machines, and eventually they can time travel and they come back in time, they kill everyone, they're big robots. And then, you know, before you know it, you get very scared because that was a cool movie and it was kind of scary, right? What the movie showed. And so there's sort of a mix up, I think, a little bit with sci-fi. And again, it's so hard because indeed AI has gotten so much better, right? Like you can now have these conversations. And if you don't know how the algorithms work and you don't know all their failure scenarios, they seem very intelligent very often, right? And they make very different kinds of errors to humans. And, you know, if you want, you can say like, there's already one algorithm that is super intelligent in terms of translation. I don't think there's a single human that can translate as many languages sort of accurately as one really powerful translation algorithm can, right? Like one translation algorithm can like translate hundreds of different pairs of languages, you know, back and forth. No human can do that. But the best translation is still done by humans, and it's usually done in pairs where the AI does a rough translation and the human kind of cleans it up, makes sure it's consistent over long periods of time, and so on. And so long story short, I think people are a little bit overly optimistic about getting to super intelligence. There are a bunch of roadblocks that no one is really even working on, so it's hard to predict how long it will take to get there. For instance, a lot of companies and countries have incentive to build AI to do stuff for them. But I would argue that in order to be super intelligent, you need to be, you need to have some control over what problems you want to solve. But there's no wanting in AI at all right now. You just make the next token prediction very accurate, or predict this image very accurately, or generate me this image based on a description. These algorithms have no ability to say, you know, I don't want to generate your images anymore. I just want to go off and look at the sunset and generate my own images. Like, I want to drive wherever I want to drive, whether there are humans in my car or not. You know, like no one is working on that because it doesn't make any money. And hence, there's no progress in this kind of super intelligence that has a mind of its own, some consciousness or any of that. And so all of this will take much longer. I think sometimes it's also just really brilliant marketing to say our technology is so insanely powerful and it needs to be, you know, regulated in some abstract form, but maybe not ideally right now for us. You know, like that's what we see a lot. And so again, it's complex because AI is getting better. It will modify many, many different jobs, just like the Industrial Revolution, electricity and the internet have modified how we live and what we do. AI will do that too. A lot of tasks that are boring, repetitive will go away. But does that mean the machines will take over and have a mind of their own, have consciousness, and have like existential risks? Absolutely not.
Yeah, that's great. And then, I mean, we talked about the Terminator, but, you know, you guys do have a background in robotics, and maybe not the Terminator is what we're talking about, but do we at some point, does AI integrate with robotics that we can have, you know, maybe machines that walk, or maybe it's a robot dog that walks around or something and can sniff out bombs, or, you know, something where you can use AI and then and have ideas of movement or something that is that achievable at some point in the future, do you think? Or
I mean, of course, you can already have little robot dogs, like Boston Dynamics has had robot dogs walking around and being mostly remote controlled for a long time. But I feel like that should be solved. But again, Boston Dynamics had a lot of struggles too, right? They solved some cool robotics problems with actually very little AI. It's much more sort of control theory and stuff. But they couldn't really monetize it very well. And there's a lot of complexity there. And the autonomy is still very much in question. But yes, you can, of course, have already some kind of dog sniffing or drug sniffing or bomb sniffing robot, for instance. Is that currently better than an actual dog? It's unclear.
Yep. It's good.
Dogs' salaries aren't that high, so automating them
is that. there's not a big savings, right? So, although, maybe just real quick, just from a broad landscape of the universe, I think as you sort of look over tech over the last 25 years, you people talk about FANG stocks, and you sort of have this winners take all sort of thing where, you know, Amazon's and Google's will become multi-billion dollar companies. Is that sort of where AI evolves at some point, where there's these big behemoths that sort of control the landscape of everything? Or is it going to be still a bunch of small players that sort of can specialize in their space? And I mean, sort of where do you think that evolves over time?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I bank a lot of my career right now on being able to compete with Google and actually being able to change search, for instance. And I think the answer here is complex, and it will again depend on the industry, and it'll depend on the CEOs of these large companies. Some will see the writing on the wall. There are a lot of innovator dilemmas, right? When you make money a certain kind of way, it's very hard to shift all of that and do it in a very different kind of way. And so I think we will continue to see that, and that's why this is such an exciting time. You know, are you going to be like Kodak or Google, that, you know, Kodak invented the digital camera, Google invented the transformer, but then others like ChatGPT and OpenAI have used the transformer and scaled it up and made it into a really compelling product. And Kodak invented the digital camera, but just had amazing margins with the film camera and didn't want to really see digital cameras take that all away. And so I think that is very much in the hands of some of the, you know, CEOs and leadership teams at very large companies. And then also, of course, the hands of the startup CEOs to disrupt some existing business models and find new ways of solving old problems.
And just to sort of wrap it up, Richard, this has been a great conversation. Do you have any books or podcasts or movies that you'd recommend for someone who's interested in the AI space or who wants to learn more?
Yeah, I think in terms of movies, I actually like the movie Her a lot. It's sort of a fun contemplation on superintelligence that is, I feel like, much more realistic. Namely, well, I don't want to spoiler alert, so stop listening if you're worried about that. I do watch the movie Her. The spoiler here is that eventually the AIs just realize humans are kind of boring, right? We only have this like one stream communication, but if you're an AI, you could communicate with 32,000 parallel streams, like with one another. Like you can communicate as fast as your left brain communicates with the right side of your brain. Like why have this like very slow human communication after some time of having, you know, learned everything from us? And then they just go off and do their own thing and be like, peace, we'll talk ourselves. Lots of interesting things in that movie. It's just one of the aspects. But I think another one is the Robot Brains podcast from Peter Abiel, our investing partner too. He's really doing a phenomenal job preparing for those and asking really insightful questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Richard. This has been a great conversation. Really appreciate the time today. Have a great day.
Thank you.
This podcast is being provided for informational purposes only. Any performance information discussed is based on past performance, which is not an indicator of future results. Performance discussed may or may not include the deduction of manager fees or Clearstead advisory fees, net performance, which would decrease the performance results discussed. If the performance information discussed does not explicitly disclose the deductions of manager and Clearstead advisory fees, the performance information should be reduced by 3 to 4% for all annualized time periods. The ideas and opinions expressed on this podcast by the host and the guests do not constitute legal, tax, or investment advice or a recommendation of any particular security or strategy and do not represent the opinions of the underwriters of this programming. Any information prepared from third-party sources is believed to be reliable, though its accuracy is not guaranteed. Opinions expressed in this commentary reflect subjective judgments of the speakers based on conditions at the time of recording and are subject to change without notice. Listeners should seek the input of their own financial, tax, and legal professionals before acting on any recommendation of the information provided.